This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Although many Black Friday sales have been underway for weeks, the Friday after Thanksgiving, 2 days from now, is the official day. There have been and will be hordes of people searching for the best deals on a lot of different items, some for themselves, others as gifts. And many of those sought-after items fall into the technology or gadget category. Buying a TV used to be easy. Today, not so much. There are lots of things to consider. If you're in the market for a laptop or a tablet, you have more decisions to make. The best smartphone may depend on how you want to use it. And all of those decisions need to be made before you decide to grab a bargain. Because if you end up not liking the item, it is no bargain, no matter the price. Meanwhile, there are lots of new gadgets that may have caught your eye that didn't even exist a few years ago or even last year. You may know little about them, and yet you want one. So this hour, we get some expert advice from folks who follow technology for a living. Ben Johnson is host of Marketplace Tech, which you can hear every weekday at 5:50 a.m. here on WFAE. He also hosts the digital-only podcast Codebreaker, and he joins us from Marketplace Studios in New York. Ben, please tell me that you pre-record the 5:50 and don't have to be there that early in the morning.
Every day that there's not intense breaking tech news, I'm usually fast asleep, Mike. Thanks.
Also with us in New York is Tim Moynihan, editor of the Gadget Lab at Wired. In a past life, he was senior editor at PC World, homepage editor at CNET, and online producer at Tech TV. Incidentally, Wired has new gift guides nearly every day on their site at wired.com. Tim, thank you for being here, too.
Hey, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And speaking of CNET, we'll be joined later in the program by their senior editor. We're going to try and cover a lot of territory this hour, but let's begin with something I really thought we'd never talk about at the consumer level or at the tech and gadget level, and that is drones. You can buy a drone. In fact, Consumer Technology Association has estimated that 400,000 drones will be sold this holiday season in this country alone. Now, just what kind of drones are we talking about here? I'm not sure who should take that question. Maybe the gadget guy, Tim.
Yeah, I can jump in. Drones these days are really specialized, and I think they will continue to be really specialized. I think the main use case is photography and videography. They're sort of like a replacement for owning your own helicopter because you can just do these amazing flyby shots. But what's shaking out is there's a lot of hobbyist movement where people are doing things like battling drones in the sky, racing drones, and that kind of thing. But it's mainly, I think, a niche sort of hobbyist phenomenon right now.
So why would I want a drone? Seriously, me personally, why would I want one?
It's sort of, you know, it's the same reason you would buy like a model airplane that you could fly around. I think there's a fun factor to it that might be sort of peaking this year. And when people think of drones, they think of these large sort of, expensive and sort of obnoxious things flying around in the sky. But there's also a lot of movement in like the toy sector where, there are smaller drones that are designed for being flown indoors. They don't have they have cameras on them, but they're not, high resolution cameras. Mm-hmm. And I think those are going to sell pretty well this year.
So are these toys or are these something more than toys? Or can you buy a toy drone versus a more professional but still consumer level drone?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, there's stuff at the high end like the DJI Phantom lineup, the Unique Typhoon, things like that. 3D Robotics has drones. Those are $1,000 and up. And those have like really, really, really good cameras on them. They shoot 4K video and they have stabilization systems. You can do a lot of things with them in terms of programming them. But we're talking about at the $100 to $200 end. There are sort of these drones from Parrot is a company based in France that has a line of what they're calling mini drones. And those have like really low resolution cameras on them that you can fly around with your smartphone. So it's, that's on the toy level of things.
Well, can you, aftermarket, can you take those cameras off or add a camera from GoPro, or is the device not built to support that at that level?
Oh, at the toy end, no. Those are all built-in low resolution cameras. So at the higher end, yes, you get into real serious configuration where you can swap in hardware, even swap out the gimbals, which is the stabilization system for those. They're really two different. I mean, it's the difference between buying like a high performance PC for video editing and like a tablet. You know, that's two different things, really. So drones is sort of an all-encompassing term that is really sort of differentiating itself within it.
So they start at about $100, and they and go up from there. We have a producer here who told me a story about they're buying a drone for their summer vacation, and they took it to the beach for its first flight. And immediately it dunked itself into the ocean. End of drone. So
I hope it was one of the cheap ones.
So do I.
So, more of a drown?
Yes, more of a drown. So how begs the question, how difficult are these things to fly? Because once they go up in the air, if you can't fly it, it's coming down somewhere quickly.
Yeah. Ideally not on somebody's head also. I mean, that's something to think about. I mean, the $100 ones, they're really light. You know, they're really sort of toy drones. And they have, you know, on the smartphone apps, a lot of them have like one button, you know, land the drone kind of things. So there is some skill involved with you know, flying them around in the air. But when it comes to things like landing them and maybe keeping them out of harm's way, there are, you know, guardrails around all the rotors, and they're just made out of sort of lightweight plastic. So I think on the toy end, those aren't really dangerous items. When you start getting into the heavy, expensive drones, then you're talking about you need a skilled pilot.
And Morley Safer on 60 Minutes did a piece on this about 2 years ago, and the drones he was talking about had GPS on them. So if they lost the signal that you were transmitting it to guide it, it would know to come back home to where it took off from. That must be a high dollar drone. That can't be the toys.
Some of the toys have something similar, but we're talking about also a difference in battery life, where the larger drones can sort of fly around longer, so they can go further, pretty much. The toy drones, a lot of them, yeah.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say it is really interesting too how you can now sort of pre-program flight paths on some of these drones. You can do that with the Phantoms. And it's really interesting to watch because you can pre-program a flight path, and then you can actually look through the camera in real time on your smartphone. You can watch what the camera is seeing on your smartphone while the drone is flying through these predetermined coordinates. And so I think there's a lot of interesting things that are starting to happen as far as that goes and using the GPS and things like that.
So where do you buy these things? I mean, do you buy them in toy stores? Do you buy them at Best Buy? Can you get a variety of levels of quality or cost at Best Buy or other technology stores?
I think I think Best Buy probably sticks to the lower end stuff, but you know the higher end stuff, I would like specialty camera stores are even starting to sell these things. Huh. I mean they're really like a video production piece of hardware at this point, I think.
Well, now you've reported, Ben, on the proposed drone regulations that came out, I think, Monday by the FAA. How might those regulations impact what you can actually do with your drone, where you can fly it, and how high you can fly it?
Yeah, well, they might do a lot. I mean, if these proposed regulations are sort of accepted and pushed through with this emergency motion to sort of push them through, we could have them by the time people's batteries are charged after Christmas. They'd require all drones between 0.55 and 55 pounds to be registered. You know, I won't go into the mathematical proof that the task force used to determine that drones lighter than half a pound or so were not a significant threat to human life. But it looked pretty complicated. You know, registration, I think, Mike, will mean, you know, you're going to get you're going to have to go onto the web or use an official app to register your drone if it's, you know, between those weight settings. And then you're going to have to actually write a registration number on the drone itself, probably. That is sort of connected to your certificate or your license.
Why wouldn't they do that at point of purchase?
That's a good question. I think that the reason, my guess is that the reason is a lot of people already have these things. And maybe they're anticipating a lot of pushback from, you know, from merchants that, you know, don't want to go through that process. And maybe also a little bit of control. You know, I've talked to some hobbyists who are actually a little bit concerned about the FAA being and the Department of Transportation being the sort of steward of all this registration information and not having it be a little bit more openly accessible to, you know, to the drone users and drone owners themselves. So, you know, I don't know. I have heard people make the comparison to gun registration. I don't know if that's exaggerating or not, but I do think that a lot of the hobbyists are actually really concerned about this and how it's going to play out.
Well, part of the problem, I think, is it not due to the fact that we've had a lot of incidences now where commercial aircraft pilots have come very close, in their opinions, to drones in their flight path, on their landing or takeoff flight path at airports. And also there's a concern about privacy issues because these things have cameras on them.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the sightings of drones at or near, you know, landing strips has, you know, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's jumped really intensely in the past year. I mean, these things are really growing in terms of how many people are using them and playing around with them. Privacy advocates, I think drones should be broadcasting their registration information in some cases. That, you know, some people have advocated for that so that they could potentially be logged or traced by some other technology if they, you know, went into somebody's yard without asking while people are, you know, I don't know, sunbathing or something. So, you know, I think it's been really difficult for the FAA to please everyone here and will remain difficult. And that's maybe why they're using this sort of emergency measure to push these rules through.
So, Tim, is this the year to do this? 400,000 people are going to be buying these things this year at Christmas time. Is this the year to do it, or should we wait until all these rules and regulations have settled down and until we've gotten to the next generation of drones in which battery life may be greater, they may be able to fly farther, etc.?
Well, I think people need to sort of keep that in mind where, you know, if they buy a drone, they might be very, you know, it might be, regulations might be stricter going forward. And I think, you know, Ben mentioned it's sort of, you know, people are comparing it to registering a gun. I think it's more like having a license plate on your car where you could just trace back, you know, something to the pilot and make them responsible for their actions. You know, in addition to the airstrip stuff that you mentioned, there's also been firefighters that have sort of been, you know, interrupted by drones flying around. And of course, there was one that either crashed on the White House lawn or flew by the White House.
Yeah, a couple this year. Yeah.
Yeah, it's all this stuff that makes you realize why we don't have flying cars yet. Because if people are doing this with drones, then if everybody was flying around in a car in the sky, it would be even worse. But I think, you know, you know, if people want a toy drone, I don't think there's that much of a risk in doing it. If people are thinking about, you know, buying a heavy-duty drone and sort of using that for professional photography, then they just need to be wary that stricter regulation might be coming up.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about many things, including virtual reality, TVs, streaming devices, computers, tablets, smartphones. If it's tech, we're talking about it today. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAU. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Alpine Ski Center, outfitting skiers and snowboarders with performance winter outerwear accessories and snow sports gear for all ages. Alpine is open every day till Christmas. And Novant Health Center, Health Cancer Center, providing customized treatment plans and a team of professionals to help give patients the support they need. Information available at novanthealth.org/cancer. Bread has been one of the world's most important foods. But in recent years, our obsession with carbohydrates has caused bread to fall on hard times. It has also pushed bread bakers to experiment with new formulas using different kinds of grains and to take gluten-free and allergy-friendly approaches to open up a whole new world of bread. One of those experimenters is our own chef on assignment and master baker Peter Reinhardt. He and others will talk about the bread revolution on Thanksgiving morning at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, French President Hollande meets with President Obama in Washington to seek additional U.S. support in the fight against ISIS in Syria. NATO holds an emergency meeting over the downed Russian fighter jet. International military action in Syria.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, along with Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech, which you hear weekday mornings here on WFAE at 5:50. Tim Moynihan is also with us, editor of Gadget Lab at Wired.com. We're going to move on from drones into something else, but one of the drones that we didn't talk about, the Bebop 2. Can be piloted by an app on your tablet or your smartphone, but also through a proprietary controller, the Sky Controller, to which you can hook up a virtual reality headset for a more immersive experience, they say. So that brings us to something else I never thought we'd talk about, at least not in this universe, virtual reality. At what stage of development is this technology, and how many different devices or gadgets are there on the market at holiday time for you to experience it?
Ben. There's a lot, actually. We've been talking about this since, I don't know, that movie Lawnmower Man came out, right? This has been a conversation that's been going on for a really long time, and people have been expecting virtual reality to sort of come into the world for a while, and we're finally... I don't want to get ahead of myself, but I think we're finally at that point. We're finally at this point where we're starting to see consumer models be available to people and really interesting applications and content being built for VR headsets. Now, there's the Samsung Gear VR is the one that became available just recently, and it costs $100, which is a pretty low price point for these things. And it, of course, only works with several of Samsung's flagship phones, right? And I think that it's going to be used as a kind of interesting introduction to the platform. But you also have Google Cardboard, which is much cheaper. The Oculus Rift is coming early next year. There's a lot of options.
Now, when you say I have... Well, I'm going to back up because I'm not sure what I have. I take the New York Times, and a couple of Sundays ago, they sent out a little box. It was a cardboard box, and inside the cardboard box was a cardboard box that you unfold and unwrap, and you stick your smartphone. You download an app on your smartphone, and you stick the smartphone in there, and you can see some virtual reality videos. You wrote about the Lion King, Tim. I think it was you. The Disney Lion King, you can see that, the opening number, on this device. You can see some of Conan O'Brien's shows on this device using this app. And I did this yesterday. Is that Google Cardboard?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. You could also do that with the Samsung Gear VR. But what's happening now, and I think we're in the very, very, very early stages of VR, and I agree it's going to be really, really exciting moving forward. What's happening is, our smartphones are powerful enough to be able to handle this stuff. And I think Google Cardboard is amazing because it's so cheap. But also, I think there's some sort of fear in the industry that it's like people are just going to think that Google Cardboard is the end-all be-all of VR. And
it's not.
But it is a very cheap way for people to be able to experience it. And, what the New York Times did, I think, was ingenious by, sending out millions of these little cardboard viewers that, introduced this medium to a lot of different people. Moving forward, we're going to see early next year, we're going to see some amazing stuff coming out of Oculus and Sony. HTC Vive is another platform.
None of you have mentioned Microsoft HoloLens, which I've which I've heard reviewers talk about who have actually experienced it. And if you went to the unveiling of, I think it was the not Windows 10, but they, when they unveiled the Surface 4 and they unveiled the other things,
they
did a big demonstration of how that works. Of course, it doesn't really look like what they showed you, but you haven't talked about HoloLens yet.
Well, there's a HoloLens is sort of technically augmented reality, right, Tim?
I don't know.
So, like, and that's, I guess, a little bit different in that it's something that you're actually wearing and you're still kind of seeing your environment, but there's additional holographic images and things like that being put into your environment. Now, I don't know how sort of strong the line is between virtual reality and augmented reality, but I think HoloLens technically falls under augmented reality.
Yeah.
But we are, I think Tim's right, though. We are at the very, very early stages of this. But it's really interesting to see some consumer options coming out and people starting to be introduced to this stuff.
Well, talk to me about the difference between virtual reality and augmented reality. Because which is Google Cardboard?
That's VR.
That's VR. Now, why is that virtual versus augmented?
Because your full frame of view is, driven by the phone. And I think that HoloLens is more being, overlaying digital information or things that are coming through the phone into a view of your immediate environment. So it would be like, photoshopping things into your actual viewpoint.
Now, maybe I should.
If you're wearing Google Cardboard and a drone's about to hit you in the face, you're not going to be able to slap it away. And if you're wearing the HoloLens, you might be able to slap it away.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the Google Cardboard, aside from being remarkably uncomfortable because it's cardboard and it's sharp on the edges, and maybe I should have put my contact lenses in and not worn glasses because I don't think my field of vision was all that good. I watched the Lion King video on it, and I have some questions. I don't know how it works, and I don't think we need to go into how it works, but when you're watching the video, you can follow things. Like, for instance, there's an elephant coming down the aisle because it's the Lion King opening number. In normal television, you would only see the elephant coming down the aisle. But with this, if you simply turn your head to the front of the elephant and keep going, you see what's in front of the elephant all the way off to the distance. And if you turn the other way, you can see it to the back of the elephant. You look up, you can see the lights. If they're on the stage, you look down, and to the left, you can see the audience watching the show. Mm-hmm. What's the value in that?
I thought it was going to be a totally different question.
Yeah, so did I. I think people are figuring this out, right, Tim? I mean, there are some companies that are, there are going to be applications for this that don't actually blow your mind. And then there are going to be applications for it that are. I mean, I've talked to people just this month, actually, who are experimenting with this idea that VR can actually increase one's empathy. And are starting to figure out ways to introduce people to issues and situations that actually make them understand something better. So, there are applications for this that are basically all about world hunger, applications for this that actually try to put the viewer literally in a different body. And I think that there are a lot of potential upsides for everything from treatment of different disorders and things like that to just actually expanding your view and your understanding of the world. Whether or not that includes the first scene of Lion King, I don't know.
And they are actually, Tim, making movies for VR headsets, Total Cinema 360. Are these normal movies or are these special movies specially made?
Well, what's exciting to me is that it is very much in the directors figuring out what to do with VR stage. So if you think about, if you think about the history of film, there were very basic films at first, then you got to talkies, then you got to just master directors who were doing things differently. We're at that first stage. We're not even at the talkie stage right now. so the thing that I think is exciting coming up in the next year Things like Oculus and of course, you know, Facebook owns Oculus or bought Oculus, is sort of the potential there for you know, distant human connection. If you think about what FaceTime and video chat has done in that realm, this is going to take that a step further. And also the potential for gaming with something that's coming up called positional tracking. So right now, like you were saying, when you're watching The Lion King, it's almost like being in a swivel chair, right?
Yes.
You can look around in 360 degrees. You can look up and down, and it reacts to those movements. But what's happening very soon is you'll be able to move around within these environments as if it was its own world. And that's when, mm-hmm. you know, gaming is going to be amazing. What Ben was saying about being able to empathize with situations and being able to interact with the environment around you, even though it's not real, that really has potential to be a groundbreaking medium to me.
That is when we'll be on the holodeck, on the Star Trek holodeck.
Yes.
We're talking to Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech, Tim Moynihan, editor of Gadget Lab at Wired.com, and now we're joined for the remainder of the hour by the senior editor of CNET.com, Bridget Carey. She is also the writer and host of CNET Update, a daily tech news show, and in a world seemingly dominated by men, Bridget went into tech journalism, she says, because she was born 150 years too early to join Starfleet. Speaking of the holodeck, Bridget, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you here. Let's talk about television, because everybody's buying TVs for Black Friday, and there were big stories on the networks last night about how cheap these televisions are, and not just high definition, but these new 4K, ultra-high definition televisions. You know, 3D was all the rage a year or two ago, and it really didn't catch on. Will 4K TVs catch on, Bridget?
Well, I think this is the year that people will start to really think about buying an ultra-high-def 4K TV. And, of course, the key to everything is, when can I watch television in 4K? We're just starting to get some content on streaming services and, you know, just having a few 4K movies come out, but it all comes down to, you know, having the content that is high definition.
Well, that was the problem with 3D, too, wasn't it? We had all, you put the glasses on with the 3D movie, it looks like it's great, but then nobody broadcasts in 3D.
Well, absolutely. But with 3D, there was even an extra element of problematic issues where you had, oh, how many people have the glasses in the house? Mm-hmm. Are you sitting right in front of the TV, or are you off to the side? With 4K, you don't have those kinds of complications. It's just a great way to show off to your friends on how your TV is better, so that makes it easy. You don't need glasses or accessories. In fact, we're now seeing some 4K TVs on sale for Black Friday. You're going to be seeing a lot of different models over at CNET. For our reviews, we're only recommending really the Vizio model that's on sale. You know, you can get it for about $800 now at like Dell.com. Maybe Amazon will have it too. And you're also seeing another trend with smart TVs being really cheap and having Roku streaming technology built inside the TV.
Right.
So TCL is one company that makes some cheap models. You're going to be seeing them also on sale during the weekend for $125 at Amazon and Walmart.
That's amazing. That really is amazing. Now, you know, when high-definition TV came out, all the rules changed. It used to be easy. You'd go out and you'd buy a 25-inch set or a 32-inch set. No more. You had to know, do you want 720p or 1080i? You had to know a lot of different things. Are all 4Ks created equal? If you buy a 4K TV, is it 4K everywhere? Or do you have to worry about resolution and things like that?
I think the differences when you're shopping for a TV come down to the quality of how black is the picture quality. That's one of the big testing features we do in any sort of TV. You know, how black is true black? That's always a good standard to know, you know, the quality. But with 4K, the measurement is how many pixels are packed in there. Another thing to think about when you're buying a TV like that, you can really only see the grand difference of quality the larger the TV gets. Your eye can only pick up so much, and, you know, sure, it'll look good in a store, but, you know, when they have these 4K ultra-high-def TVs that go, you know, 60, 80 inches in size, and we see them at the electronics trade shows, you know, that's when it goes, oh, wow, I see the difference then, you know. So maybe for some people it doesn't matter so much to get a 4K TV if you're going for something, you know, small.
Well, here's, I think, a key question, because if there's very little programming at the moment in 4K, the best place to see 4K is in the the electronics store, because they've got loops of 4K video playing on these things, and they are spectacular. I mean, they can be a wide shot of the city of New York taken from Brooklyn, and you can see the eyeballs on the people walking on the street in Manhattan. That's how good this thing is. But since there's no 4K content really out there, and most people get their content through cable, what does that look like on these 4K TVs? Because even high definition in cable is compressed. So there's all this video artifacting. I don't know who to ask this question of. What does it really look like when you actually put it into practice in your home?
Well,
Mike,
I mean,
sorry. Go ahead, Bridget.
Well, I mean, I was just going to point out that you're kind of future-proofing yourself here, because, you know, television itself is going to look not that different, probably, you know, but it's more about when you do want to watch 4K on Netflix or Amazon Prime, they're starting to offer Ultra HD. You can do that for some shows. And also some cell phones now and cameras are all shooting in 4K. So if you're doing home movies and you want to see it in the best quality possible, you know, might as well, like, get the package and get both.
Ben?
I think Bridget's right. You're definitely sort of getting ready for the future of content there. I think another thing to note, Mike, is that the 4K part of this right now in some ways isn't actually as important as some of the other things that come with the 4K TV. Some of the other ways that the different models are playing with color and figuring out to get a better picture. I mean, 4K, yes, it's bigger. Does that mean it's better? Not always, I don't think. Well, I think it's just marketing there.
One of the manufacturers is adding an extra pixel. They're adding a yellow pixel. Mm-hmm. I don't know which one that is, but I've seen it, and I can tell a difference.
Yeah, that's sharp.
You can.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that a gimmick? Are curved TVs a gimmick? I mean, how do I know what to do here? Because no one's going to tell you the truth.
I would say curved TVs are a gimmick.
Okay.
And just looping back to what you said, like, are all 4K TVs created equally? What's happened in the last year is that some standards have sort of come into play across the industry. If you're thinking about buying a 4K TV and you really want a future-proof 4K TV, you want to look for two things, and that's HDMI 2.0 and HDCP 2.2. What that's going to do is it's just going to sort of make that TV play better with things that are coming up on the horizon. One of those things is 4K Blu-ray, which should be introduced, I guess, early next year. The first sort of players and titles should be available. But I think, like, there's the transition from HD to 4K is going to be a lot easier for the simple fact that they both have the same aspect ratio.
Right.
So when you went from SD to HD, you either got a letterboxed picture or a stretched out picture that looked terrible.
Mm-hmm.
From HD to 4K, all 4K TVs upscale HD content. So you're not going to get 4K content from an HD cable feed, but you're going to get something that looks at least as good as HD and probably a little bit better.
If you're not ready to do this, but you know you want to do this, is this the time to buy a television, or should you wait just before Super Bowl time when they also seem to go on sale?
I think those are the two best times.
It's
pretty much between those two.
The only time better than right now to buy a TV will be around the Super Bowl.
Okay.
I think, yeah.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about streaming devices, smartwatches, other wearables, PCs, tablets, and everything else we can fit in the time allotted. As we continue talking to Bridget Carey, senior editor and writer and host of CNET Update at CNET.com, Tim Moynihan, editor of Gadget Lab at Wired.com, and Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech, which you hear here on WFAE every day. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Queen City Audio, Video, and Appliances, local purveyors of premium appliances since 1952, including KitchenAid. More information about KitchenAid's new look at queencityonline.com. And Historic South End celebrating this holiday season during Small Business Saturday this Saturday. Over 200 shops offering unique gifts for all on that holiday shopping list. Details at historicsouthend.com. French President Hollande meets with President Obama in Washington to seek additional U.S. support in the fight against ISIS in Syria. And NATO holds an emergency meeting over the downed Russian fighter jet. Coming up in 20 minutes of the Diane Rehm Show at 10, an update on international military strategy in Syria. If you have questions about tech and gadgets on Black Friday, now's your chance. You can search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter or email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. We're coming right back.
This Giving Tuesday, December 1st, WFAE encourages you to support the charities that you are passionate about. Volunteer, make a donation, or just share the good work of a charity you love. You can make a tax-deductible contribution to WFAE at 704-549-9000 or online at WFAE.org. No matter which charity you support this Giving Tuesday, know how thankful we all are for your support of our shared community.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Ben Johnson from Marketplace Tech, Tim Moynihan from Wired.com, and Bridget Carey from CNET.com. We're going to do a lightning round here in the next 18 minutes as we catch up on all the things we haven't talked about yet. Let's go to streaming devices. We have Apple TV, Roku, Chromecast, Xbox, etc. Is one better than another? How do you choose?
I'm all about the Roku.
You're all about the Roku. Why is that?
Because it's just the one that plays nice with the most services. You're seeing happening now is a little bit of a battle between Amazon streamers and Apple streamers, where like you can't get the Amazon apps on Apple and you can't get some apps on Amazon. And with Roku, it has the most options for whatever service you want to pay for. You're going to find it. Of course, everyone's got their ups and downs, but I mean, Apple's the most expensive, but if you have a bunch of Apple products in your home, then you're going to want the Apple one because you already live in the Apple life. And with Roku, it just has a lot more different options for maybe the different needs of some people. You know, you have really cheap versions just to get your basic Netflix across, to high-end versions that can have remote controls that actually have headsets jacks, you know, so you don't have to bother your partner if they're sleeping. You can listen to the TV through earphones by plugging it into your remote. So there's all different types of options with the Roku.
So Roku,
I think the new Apple TV is really good too. I mean, a lot of people have given really, really good reviews of that, mm-hmm. and it's the most similar to, you know, if you're buying, say you're buying for someone who is not super tech savvy with streaming devices, the Apple TV in some ways is going to be the most familiar to them. It's got an actual remote, as do some of the others. Mm-hmm. But, it, you know, that remote you can talk to, it has Siri functionality in it. You know, the user interface is really good. I'm a Chromecast guy. I love the Chromecast.
And that's cheap.
It's so cheap and it's so amazing. I have actually, my Chromecast is plugged into my flat screen, and my stereo is also plugged into my flat screen so that I can listen to all of my Google Music through my stereo and then just switch to television. And I think Chromecast is also kind of cool because it you know, it's really good about mirroring. So if you want to mirror your device or your laptop or something like that on your television, it works really well for that. And you can sort of share it with others. People can sort of cast YouTube videos.
That's 35 bucks, right?
It's 35 bucks.
Yeah.
So to me, that's like a great motivator, how cheap it is.
So a quick question. Roku has a box. They have a stick. Chromecast mm-hmm. is a stick or a dongle. Amazon has a box and a stick. Box over stick?
I mean, a box is going to be more powerful. All the boxes on the market are more powerful. They're probably better for gaming too. I'll take the one that hasn't been mentioned, which is not as my favorite. I agree with both Bridget and Ben that like the Roku is probably the best right now. The Apple TV might be the best going forward, just because they've opened up the app ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So that's going to open the door for a lot of new games. Not so much yet, but I think the app ecosystem there is going to be something that really grows in the next year. The Chromecast is the great cheap option for streaming stuff from your device. But the Fire TV, the newest one, it supports 4K. It's cheaper than the Roku. And they've also added Alexa capabilities, which is the Amazon Echo, which is another device I'm not sure you're familiar with.
Nope.
It's basically like a voice-activated coffee can that you can talk to, and it's a Bluetooth speaker, so you can, you know, come home and say stuff like, Alexa, put on Jethro Tull at maximum volume, and it'll do that and make shopping lists and all that stuff.
So Alexa is a cousin of Siri and Cortana, right?
Yeah. And it's a weird device to explain, because it, like, when that came out, everybody thought it was crazy. My friend has one, and it was so fun to play with and actually pretty useful.
And how much is that?
I think that's a little under 200.
It's like $180. I got it right here.
Yeah, it's 180.
Bucks. Yeah.
Okay.
It looks like a black cylinder.
Right. So Amazon has added that to Fire TV, their newest box. So, you know, that's a cool little feature that's sort of an add-on.
So when it comes to wearables and things like smartwatches, Apple Watch, is that still the king of the hill, or are we seeing Android take over as they have kind of taken over because they have more different devices out there?
Well, it's only the king if you have an Apple iPhone. You know, it's something right now that definitely gets a lot of attention.
But then I heard about this watch yesterday I'd never heard about, called Pebble Time. It's compatible with both the Apple and Android ecosystems. Other than that, how does it differ from other smartwatches?
Oh, it's actually even on sale this weekend, too. It's Black Friday. You can get it for like $130 and save about $70 or so. But when it comes to Pebble, they have a couple different looks. They use that same kind of screen you see on an e-reader, where it's, you know, black and white, and the battery lasts longer, the Pebble Time even comes in color. But this is something that does work on both iPhones and Android phones, but doesn't have as many, I guess you could say, doesn't have as much functionality as, like, if you have an iPhone going with an Apple Watch, or having an Android going with an Android Wear Watch.
So if you're in the Android world, as many people are, is there a favorite watch?
I think the LG watch is pretty good, I still love the Moto 360. I just think it's a really beautiful device. It has some problems, not the least of which is that little piece of the screen at the very bottom of the circle on the watch face that doesn't actually do anything.
If you get the Moto 360, can you use it with a Samsung phone?
Yeah, I believe you can. And most Android phones will work with it. But I have to say, I don't know about Tim and Bridget, but I'm sort of a smartwatch skeptic. I don't think they've quite figured it out yet. This is something that's supposed to be tens of billions of dollars worth of industry, I don't know, in the next 5-10 years. I don't know. You still have to charge this. It's an extra thing to charge. The Arthur C. Clarke law is supposed to be that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, right? And I just don't, I don't think that smartwatches are there yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
I totally agree with you. I mean, it's something where we're still going, why can I not just get that same information by looking at my phone? We're waiting for those apps that come out that kind of make it easier to live your life rather than just have, like, a copy of what you can do on your phone already. That's why Pebble is kind of interesting, because it's cheaper if you want to just play around in this space and say that you have a smartwatch and, you know, kind of live that life on, you know, as it's all being figured out right now.
What about other wearables? What about Fitbit versus Microsoft Band versus the other brands that are out there, if you're trying to keep track of how many steps you walk every day or things like that?
Well, Fitbit, I think, is still the market leader in terms of market share. Apple Watch is sort of catching up in the wearable market. Yeah. I think they're actually neck and neck. But, those are sort of different animals, and I think that's sort of indicative of, you know, the smartwatches, I wouldn't say failure, but, you know, people by and large are a little bit skeptical of it. The battery life is an issue, and then there's a catch-22 where things like the Fitbit that don't have, you know, a bigger touch screen or are always interacting with your phone or something like that, those are going to have longer battery life, but of course they're more limited in functionality. And then there's a catch-22 where I think in order for smartwatches to really be more appealing to the masses, they need to be more of a standalone device. Like a lot of them now, most of them, you have to pair to a phone. So it's not really a standalone device. And even on top of that, you have to charge them every day, every 2 days. So there's a trade-off there where if they're going to become more self-sufficient devices and sort of wrist-mounted computers, then, you know, the battery life is going to have to get better, and that's really hard to do on a small device.
So very quickly, CNET's featuring the Misfit Flash as one of the only real fitness trackers you can get for $30 or less. It looks like a round-faced wristwatch with little red dots on it, and these work with both Android and iPhones. Does that fact combined with the price, Bridget, make them a wise choice? What do they track, or are you going to be unhappy the minute you put it on?
Oh, I've used it. It's one of those things that are just basic trackers of how much you're walking in the day, and it takes a typical watch battery, so these things last a while, mm-hmm. and it can be put in, or it can be worn in different ways. Like, they have necklaces you can put on, or stick it in, you know, a shoe clip, a belt clip, a watch. It looks cheap. You know, you're getting a $30 product here, but it's a good, like, entry level into, like, hey, I want to, you know, get fitness. I want to think about it more. But maybe you don't want to spend $150, $120 on something. So mm-hmm. that's what makes it interesting.
Okay, let's move on to PCs and tablets. We've heard for a long time that PC is dead. It's being replaced by the tablet. But tablet sales have been falling. Is that because PCs aren't really dead, or because we're gravitating to our phones for much of the work that we used to do on laptops and desktops?
I think the buying cycle for a tablet is really tricky. I think, you know, they're in a lot of ways they replicate the experience using a phone, but on a bigger screen. But people aren't buying them every 2 years. I think that's what's happening with tablet sales, is that there's no, you know, repeat hook to keep buying these things. But they're getting better and better and better. And the trend there is, I think the iPad Pro and the Microsoft Surface Pro 4 kind of tackle the same issue in different directions.
Well, let's talk about those, because the Microsoft Surface is supposed to be the tablet that can replace your laptop. I have a Surface 3. It has replaced my laptop. It has replaced my iPad, too, by the way, although I think the iPad apps are far superior and certainly more numerous. But iPad Pro has a keyboard, too.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a difference?
Yes. The iPad Pro cannot run Windows. But at the same time, it's
but if you're an Apple person, you don't want to run Windows. You hate Windows.
Well, yeah, totally. I totally agree with that. But, I mean, that's what I was getting at, where it's like tackling the same issue from two different directions, uh-huh. where I think the Surface is a Windows computer first, right?
Right.
And then, like you said, the app ecosystem is nowhere near as good as the iPad. And then the iPad is for someone who primarily wants to use a tablet, loves Apple's app ecosystem. And the latest one, the Pencil as well, what they're not calling a stylus, it's a pencil. that has been really, really well implemented. And I think, you know, a lot of feedback from artists, from people who draw a lot and prefer jotting by hand, really love that.
But you can do that with the Surface, and the Surface stylus has many different pen tops now. You can change your pen. So the Surface Book just came out. This is about the size of a MacBook Air, but it has a detachable screen with a discrete processor in the screen, so you can detach it from the keyboard, and it's a pretty powerful tablet. Is this a product that makes sense to you? Is this the Surface tablet that replaces the Surface?
I think Microsoft has had an interesting long game here, right? You have to admit, like, when the Surface tablets first came out, they were practically laughed out of the room when it comes to tablets, right? And I think over time, Microsoft has actually successfully made this argument that your tablet can replace your laptop and they can be interchangeable, and you can have a tablet that's a really powerful device and does a lot of stuff. Now, Microsoft's latest devices are not cheap, and that includes the Surface Book, right? But I think that Microsoft has been doing some really interesting stuff in this space, and people are finally sort of catching on.
Yeah, and I
saw somebody using one the other day on the train, and they're like a comic book artist, and they were working on the train with the stylus, and it was really interesting to watch.
And the NFL uses them at every game.
They've taken
a page from the Apple Book, because they're really well built and they're sleek and they look good. Kim writes, can your guests comment on tablets for children ages 6 through 8? We're finding that Apple has cornered the market on educational software. Anybody want to take that?
Well, I mean, it depends how young the child is, I guess.
Six to eight.
I would go with over at Amazon, because they have a app environment that is controlled. They also have this kid-friendly tablet. that even you can buy it and it comes with a bumper, and they have like kid programming that like with a lot of parental controls in it. So it just kind of makes it a little bit easier, a little less worry when it comes to getting the whole package of it. It runs Android apps, but it's just a matter of Amazon picks which Android apps it wants to have in its system.
Okay. And you can't go to the Google Play Store and download your own apps from there?
Right. And that's where that kid-friendliness kind of comes in. You can't just download any bizarro app out there in the Google Play Store. And also, if you just want to get something cheap, I mean, you don't have to get the kid version of the Amazon tablet. Amazon Fire, the brand new one, it's just plain Amazon Fire tablet. It's crazy cheap now. I mean, it's $50, and this weekend it's $35 at Amazon and Best Buy. It's just a 7-inch colored tablet, and you don't have to, you know, really freak out so much if it gets broken then.
Yeah. So Beth writes, please ask about GoPros. My 12-year-old son wants one.
The highest end new one is the GoPro Hero 4 Black. That is, I think, the first one that shoots 4K video at 30 frames per second. The past ones have shot 4K at 15 frames per second. But there, I think there are battery life trade-offs with that one as compared to the Hero 4 Silver, which I think is the step-down version. So it's a give take. If he wants 4K video, I would go with the Hero GoPro Hero 4 Black. And if he wants longer battery life, I would do the step down model.
Very quickly, from all three of you, you have a favorite phone other than the iPhone?
This is a sleeper. This has been a sleeper for me, but I actually love the Nexus 6. I didn't want to get it, and I got it because I wanted to test out Project Fi, and I love it. So,
okay, anybody else?
I like the Droid Turbo 2. It's unbreakable.
That's right. Well, yeah, then they'll let you drop it in the phone store, and they prove. I just got an LG V10. I want to tell you, I was afraid that it was going to be too big. This is a fabulous phone. I love this phone. Okay. Thank you all. Bridget Carey, senior editor, writer, host of CNET Update on CNET.com. Tim Moynihan, editor of Gadget Lab at Wired.com. And Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech. You hear it here at 5:50 every morning. Thank you all for the hour.